Welcome to How I Raised It, the podcast that goes behind the scenes with entrepreneurs who've raised capital. We uncover the tips, tricks, and techniques they use to get investors to write a check. Strap in and turn it up.
Hi, welcome to another episode of How I Raised It, produced by FounderSuite.com. Today with me, I have Andre Lorenzo of LiveLike coming to us from New York. How are you doing today?
Very good. Hi, thanks for having me here.
So I'm jealous. Andre, today it's Friday. He's taking his team to see Ready Player One. Is today the opening day of Ready Player One?
No, I think it opened like last week or something like that. Maybe Wednesday, relatively recently. But yeah, we managed to get tickets and we're going to take the whole team. It's kind of like very Genesis for you and for us.
Yes, yes. So I'm excited to hear what you think of the movie. It's there's been a lot building up about it, so should be pretty fun. Well, very good. Let's start off. You're in the virtual reality space. Tell us, what is LiveLike and how did you come up with the idea for this business?
So LiveLike is essentially a next generation sports watching platform. It started in virtuality and kind of evolved out of that to other platforms, or is still evolving out of that to other platforms. But essentially what we do is we were looking at what was being done in the world of live sports, and we saw that most other companies were focusing on the camera, the encoding, and we're just kind of, everybody was selling, we can put you first row at the game, you can feel like you're on the field. And I, as a sports fan, I'm religious about the University of Texas, I very quickly realized that I was working virtual reality. I worked a little bit in Korea with a little studio that was involved with Samsung and Oculus. And I knew more than the average person about virtual reality, and I took one of the secret prototypes that Samsung was working on to my brother Fabrice, who was in France, and he was working on a sports startup, and we kind of got our heads together, and we were like, but you know, what makes a sports experience great is not just being first row. First row is good. Don't take me wrong, I love being first row, but there's still a lot of things as part of that sports experience that make it better. Like, I mean, honestly, it's going to be very dumb sounding, but the beer is part of that sports experience.
I was actually just thinking of beer and hot dogs when you said that. Yeah. But yeah.
So your friend is actually part of the sports watching experience. If you go with your friends, you're usually not going to go first row alone. I mean, some people do, but for the vast majority of people, you would want to be there with a friend. That would make it significantly better. If we're talking about soccer, you know, imagine it's like the very beginning, you're in the first minute and then there's a shot and then, you know, you kick it off to just like kind of take it to the center of the game. At that moment, nobody would be angry at you if you pull out your phone and you went on Twitter or on Facebook. And essentially, that's part of the sports experience. And everything you'll do, and if you're at home and you're watching TV and you order chicken wings, that's part of the sports experience. If you call your friends, that's part of your sports experience. So we looked at the sports experience as something that's not just the video and being in the first row. We were like, your experience initially in VR, but then other platforms as well, has to do more. Your VR experience has to bring in your social media. It has to bring in your friends. It has to bring in your food. It has to bring in fantasy football, betting. It has to bring in everything that you do in sports inside of that experience. And that was a radically different take. And we you know, we're still at the beginning of that. I mean, we brought your friends in there because we built a social module so you and your friends can hang out in there. But we have a lot more that we want to build in that direction.
So give us the very short version though. So right now, do my friends and I put on these goggles and we're able to watch a soccer game? We're in different locations, but we can kind of watch it as if we're together. I mean, what's the actual current experience right now?
Yeah, so right now it's on mobile VR, so Gear VR, and soon a couple more mobile-based VR experiences. So yeah, you put on goggles, and you're in a VIP suite that's like computer-generated VIP suite, and in front of you, you have the video of the stadium, and it's meant to feel like you're there. It's meant to be like you can be on the field, or you can be up in the stands, or behind the net, and stuff like that. And yeah, you'll launch an application on your phone that'll be called depending on the territory you're in, and it depends on who the media right holder is. So in the UK, we've worked with BT and Sky. In the US, we have Fox Sports VR that has every day. we're in many, many territories. And so, yeah, the idea is that you can go in there and you launch the live TV or live stadium view, and you then have a little Facebook invite button where you can connect your Facebook. It'll pop up a page, you log in, and then whoever has launched the application that has connected their Facebook as well, you'll see your friend Frank or Andre, and you'll be like, oh, I want to watch with Frank or Andre. And you'll be able to also send links so that people can come to you. So you can post a link, be like, join me in my suite, and then the person will automatically be taken to the room with you. And you'll see each other as avatars, and you'll be able to talk over VoIP to each other. And what's really important, but people really undervalue it, is actually 3D audio. So if you try to do that, if you think about, the main reaction that a lot of people have when I tell them that, it's like, okay, cool, but I don't really need the avatar. I can call them on WhatsApp, and that's the same thing. But the big difference there is that if you have the football the commentary slash plus your friend talking plus another friend talking to somebody else, it's all on what we call the same focal points. It's all from the same source. So if you have four people talking, the audio is going to be awful. It's just going to be a bunch of blah, 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 blah. If you have 3D audio, you can literally look to your friend on the left and he'll sound like he's in front of you. And if somebody else is talking, he'll just sound like somebody in the room is talking behind you. And that actually makes all the difference in the world, because your brain can tell, I understand what this person says because you know where they are. And same for the sound of the video. It's in front of you. You understand that it's coming from the stadium. And it's not jarbling over what these people are saying. And if you want to hear what the people on your right are saying, you just turn to them and you'll be able to tell just from the source of the 3D audio. And that makes a giant difference.
I need to check this out. This is pretty amazing. I didn't even know there was such a thing as 3D audio. I've learned a new term today. Cool. Awesome.
So,
well, really
actually,
cool.
Little 3D audio, very easy to check it out. Sorry. 3D audio. Go to YouTube. There's a video called Virtual Haircut. Put on some headphones. Try it out because it will blow your mind. Just Virtual Haircut. It's the show that 3D audio can be done with normal headphones. Totally, totally crazy.
Virtual Haircut on YouTube. That sounds cool. I will check it out. All right. So how long have you guys been around? You started in 2015. Is that correct?
Yes. We started in early 2015. Technically, we had a prototype a little bit before, but officially we started in 2015, yeah.
And I think I saw you went through Techstars. Is that correct? Was that your first?
Yeah. Well, it wasn't the first. We kind of bounced around. So a bunch of us, when we started, were like in France. I'm originally French, and a bunch of my co-founders are as well. And we went to San Francisco pretty quickly, essentially as soon as we thought we had funding to get there. And
actually, what do you mean by that when you say you thought you had funding? Tell that story.
Yeah, there's a story behind that. essentially, the first... So I had a prototype, a nice little thing that literally I picked up an engineer on Reddit initially, and we built this little prototype, like very dingy, put together, like a video in front of a box in a VR headset kind of a thing. Not live, not anything like that. And we showed it to Broadcaster, and Broadcaster was really excited and made us move up through the corporate ranks until we got to the big executive team who loved it and told us, we want to work with you. And like, how fast can this happen? That was in France. That was like M6. And my cousin's a VC, and he wasn't going to invest in us. I wasn't going there for that, but I just went to show him. And I went to show him essentially, be like, do you know any investors be interested in this? And there happened to be in his office the same day, another investor who had just recently sold his company, was in the process of selling his company, and it was more or less supposed to be done. And he told us that he'd give us $350,000. And we were like, with that, we can definitely, I mean, at this point, it's like, I wasn't even going to take a salary for like a while. I was like, this can take us for like a year at least, like a long time. And so we went to San Francisco with that, but then, the investor never paid up. So he had some problem with his sale, and like somebody messed up his deal, and so he could never pay us. So we ended up being like in San Francisco we were a small team still, and everybody was willing to do a lot of sacrifices, and thank God. And we found ways to make it work. We got people to loan us a little bit of money until somebody else paid up, or it's another investor, but that took like probably 5-6 months, maybe 5 months probably. Something like that, maybe somewhere around that range. And and you know, that made it very tricky. It's kind of a scary story, and we were very much like borrowing like $1,000 at a time. Like we did $40,000 like literally day at a time. We're like, we can't eat. $1,000 loan for like, yeah, like a few months.
And it's a little, you hear the early days, like the Airbnb story, they had a similar thing where they're like $20,000 in credit card debt or something, and you know, living off Cheerios or something. So come over here, you think you have funding lined up, it vanishes, so now you're kind of living, you know, hand to mouth. Then what was the first amount of money in? Was it getting to Techstars, or did you raise like kind of a friends and family angel round before Techstars?
Well, unfortunately, or probably fortunately for your listeners, didn't really have friends or families that could afford anything like that. I don't come from a particularly wealthy background. Honestly, you know what helped a lot? So investors tend to follow each other a lot. And while that guy was not paying up, we thought he was still going to pay up for a long time. We thought he was going to pay up. And like literally years. And he kept telling us, no, I'm going to pay. But at that point, we were like, no, he's just slowed down, but it's going to get figured out because the sale was always supposed to be basically a done deal. Yeah. And so we were just going like, oh, you know, we were meeting other investors, but we're like, but no, we're fine. Like we weren't going to investors at all going like, oh, we need your money, because we thought we were fine. And we got, so also related to my cousin, the VC, just, we visited him multiple times to keep him up to date. And just because I went back to France, I figured I'd pop by my cousin to just update him. And we met other investors that kind of just were hanging around, because VCs, the way they raise their money is they raise it from LPs, limited partners, or so we say, and essentially, you know, VCs do two things. They spend their money and they gather more money. Their entire job is doing these two things. And so hanging around a VC office where you've got, you know, a very sexy product, very innovative, they'll have a bunch of people that have a lot of personal wealth that come and put their wealth into VC office. Now, some VC office, they only take money from banks and stuff like that, so it might not work as well. This one, it worked. So, and it was particularly a seed stage office, essentially. And so we just met a few offices like that. Then some of our employees, after we had some traction, after we had officially gathered like 400,000, they would put in another 100, 200, like distant family relations of my employees. We had we still have an Egyptian agent that represents Middle Eastern stars that just thought this was the greatest thing ever. And he managed to get his family to all put in together an amount to the real estate money, I think, and all together, you know, it made for a round. So we got into Techstars, and we actually had, I think it was including the 350,000 though, so we might have been discounted after, but at that time, I think we had $800,000 like on the books by the time we got into Techstars. So Techstars actually offers you, or at the time it offered you, I think it's still the case, but I'm not sure, $100,000 when you come in, at a pre-valuation of like $2 to $3 million. And we already had like, at that point, we already had like 800,000 with a valuation of $8 million. So we decided not to take that and just do with the money that we had.
So actually, let's unpack that just a little bit. So you get into Techstars, your valuation has already kind of exceeded what they offer. So did you not go through Techstars, or did you just not take their money?
We just didn't take their money. We actually went to Techstars, and at the time also they would ask for 6% ownership in the company for a nominal amount, and like literally 18,000 or something like that. And that we absolutely gave up, and I absolutely no regret, by the way. Techstars has been really good to me. I mean, it made, even after the program.
So you took you gave them the 6% or whatever it is, but you didn't take the money, which would have affected your valuation. Is that an accurate summary?
Yes. Yeah, essentially, yeah.
Gotcha. Okay. All right, let's go through there. So you're in Techstars. Now, you had that $800K as kind of pledged. Did you use like Techstars process and demo day to round it up and round up more money, or what was the next funding event?
So all that was in what we call convertible notes. I believe it was all essentially safe agreements, which I'm sure you've talked about it before, but if anybody doesn't know, it's kind of, they give you the money and it's kind of a loan until you do, you close an official round, and at that point just transforms magically into equity. And so I needed to close a round, which I honestly didn't do until August of the next year. So literally I got into Techstars in September, and it took like 12 months until we closed the round. So we went through Techstars. We didn't actually manage to raise really much of anything during Techstars. And I think that a lot of people, not for bad reason, expect Techstars to be where they get their money. It trains you very well to get money, but it's, you shouldn't come in there expecting that you're going to come out and bam, cash is going to fly out the door. Because, I mean, that, at least that's not what happened for us. We also kind of came at a very particular time where there was kind of a market contraction on VCs, which absolutely dictates whether or not you will live, and it's completely out of your hands. But so we struggled a little bit. We raised another convertible note, I think for $1 million in February. So we, Techstars program was September through November, essentially. Then we didn't raise anything during that time. We had plenty to spend at that point. We raised another one in like February or something like that for $1 million. And then that held out all the way through August of 2016. So it was kind of like a, we did convertible notes 6 months later, convertible notes 6 months later around, and then everything converted all at once.
Gotcha. Okay. So the actual Series A round then was, that was in August 20, what's the date on that one? 2016, 2017?
Yeah, okay. August 2016. Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay. Let's talk about that round a little bit. You know, how did you approach it? You have some interesting names on there, like Courtside VC and David Stern, whose name I've heard come up a few times. How did you raise that round? What was your approach to raising that proper Series A?
Well, I mean, honestly, I've actually just talked about this very recently with somebody else as well. It was very much tied to deliverables. So it was very much, you know, the product that we're dealing with, what we're doing, is very, we have a production component, we have a team to do production, etc. But overwhelmingly, what it is software. And it's not a small product. Doing live streaming, and on top of that, adding a lot of interactions and customization and sponsorship and stuff like that, it means a very significant amount of capital, more than a usual SaaS startup that builds a portal to something. It's much closer to the expensing of a video game development, and even a large one, than the regular startup. So we essentially just kept breaking milestones. So, you know, the first 800,000 very much raised on the fact that we had an awesome prototype. It was just something that we kept showing the broadcaster, and they were like, holy shit, this is, I keep seeing 360 videos all the time, but this is like, has more, like this makes sense. Like I understand why somebody would want this much more in a 360 video. Then 6 months later, we raised that first convertible, that second convertible note in February 2016, more on the idea that, more on the concept that we had successfully built a live streaming platform at this point. We had tested the live stream, and it wasn't nearly that reliable yet, but we had built it, and we had sort of sold a bunch of test activations to British Telecom, to a couple other people, and we had a major tournament, which was the ATP tennis tournament in Indian Wells, Los Angeles. And we were going to do basically, I think it was the whole tournament, or maybe one field, but every single day or something like that. And so we raised that round on like, look, we're defying the odds. You're also going to understand that in my space, I'm going to get to closing series in a second, but you've got to keep in mind that in my space, we were very much the underdog. We were, you know, everybody else is building crazy tech. NextVR was like the elephant in the room. They had like 25 patents. They used to be Next3D. Their executives were all like 40, 50 years of age, and were like multiple exits and stuff like that. Whereas we were a bunch of 20 something year old that were just showing up and being like, we're going to beat them. And everyone's like, okay, yeah, sure. And and so when we showed up and we're like, no, we got the contract, regardless of, and NextVR, you know, by the time we had founded the company that raised $6 million, by the time I was raising my first convertible note, I think that raised another like 16 or something. I mean, you can look up their history. It's all very public, but we were very much seen as the underdog. So every time we delivered and broke a milestone, it was like, oh, wait, like, there's something, like, on a fair fight, these guys would get crushed, but somehow they don't. And also to take note of a tiny thing is that I actually don't think that NextVR is our competitor. I don't treat them as such at all because of our business model is actually relatively different. We don't compete for the same dollar most of the time. And if NextVR does super well, we would actually be twice as valued and we would actually be twice as needed. It would make the entire space go up. But so Series A was actually very much our relationship with Fox. We got a long-term deal with Fox to do many activations that this deal still holds today. And we have an excellent relationship with Fox and we love them very much. And we get the vibe that they love us very much too and won't speak for them. But essentially when we got that deal, we managed to close the Series A going like, look, this is one of those deals that nobody else has been able to have. Like, nobody's made this much foray into the virtualized sports world and been that integrated with a broadcaster and built their platform for them, et cetera. And there's a reason for that. And it's because our theory is strong enough to carry our deals. And that worked. And for David Stern specifically, so for people who might not know who David Stern is, he pretty much built the NBA single-handedly. He took over the NBA and became commissioner, and I forgot when it was, but it was a long time ago, probably the 70s. The NBA was like, it was like 50 people or something like that. It was like a small organization. By the time he left it in 2012, it was, you know, the thousands of people that it is today, the absolutely giant organization that it is. And he actually definitely picked us because we're the underdog. He has a very strong public personality. He's a very... very rich in personality and very much you can tell he likes an underdog. So when he saw us, he was definitely approached by a lot of other people as well, but he saw us and he liked us. And he just thought like, you know what? These guys are defying the odds. They're fighting from behind and they're winning every battle. So I'm going to back that.
I love that. I love that story of, you know, playing to your underdog strength and finding people who resonate with the underdog. That's great. And so some of the other names in the round, like CAA Ventures, is that Creative Artists Agency, the talent representative?
Yeah.
And it's their venture arm. How'd you get in with those guys? I mean, that's an interesting investor on the cap table.
So that's probably the most underrated reason for our success, post-Series A, I want to say, because essentially, we actually got invested in by Evolution Media Capital, which is it's a joint funding or venture capitalism firm from CAA, which is what you said, Creative Alliance Agency, what you said, and TPG, which is a big ad as well. And we, together, they have this venture capital firm that invested in a lot of stuff. And yeah, we've been meeting a lot of people. And, you know, I think they're what I call essentially a semi-strategic. So we don't have any expectation that they would ever acquire us or anything like that, because their business is both representation of talent, and they represent everybody from David Beckham to Kanye West to Peyton Manning to whoever. But they also do a lot of media rights advisory, and they're basically all over the world. So any major league doing a big deal with Fox, with ESPN, with France Television, with whoever, they would one way or another know about it. It was their business to know.
Yeah.
And they saw in us a way to be like, look, if we invest in this and we just help them out with networking, just open doors for them, these guys are going to kill it, especially that we're underdog. And we like had way less resources. And they absolutely did. I mean, they've put in a ton of time for us and they've opened doors everywhere to the point that nowadays, don't take me wrong, startups will always have plenty of problems to deal with, but opening doors, being like, if I want to talk to anybody anywhere in the world, if I want to talk to any client, if I want to go to, I don't know, like Argentina's premier broadcasting company, I can get the network of the company can get an intro to that like in a matter of days. And you know, we're just everywhere because of that, and it's been invaluable to our success.
No, that's amazing. Yeah, You know, I think startups often don't think about the strategic investors like a CAA Ventures as much. How did you actually get in touch with them, or how did you get introduced to them? How did you plug yourself into a pitch meeting? And maybe what was that pitch meeting like? Because I'm sure that's an interesting dynamic too, maybe.
I actually forgot what the first – I do not remember what the first touch point was, because it actually took a very long time. Like, we started talking to them in like January, February time, and we closed in August. So it wasn't like a quick done deal by any stretch of the mind. I actually think they were thinking about investing in us for a long time. And then it was initially led by Jay Adia, who since then now works at Iconica Partner, which is another VC firm. But he, particularly Jay Adia, had a good relationship with one of our co-founders, Mihir, and they were actually supposed to invest in us, and then they were reworking how their funds was going to work. So they actually at the end said, never mind, we're not going to invest, which is fine. I mean, you get a lot of no's when you try to get investment.
Yeah.
And, and after a while, we just kept them updated. We kept just updating them nonstop again and again and again. We'd be like, oh, we did this event. Oh, we did this event. Oh, we did NBA. Oh, we won this award. We did this thing. And after a while, when their internal restructuring was done, they were just like, okay, look, we're like missing out on something serious here. And they just like got together and pushed it forward. So
that's cool. Well, I only think of like CAA from like Entourage, right? Where they've got, right? Ari's agency, or you think of like Jerry Maguire and the, you know, the agency there. Is that real life? What's it really like inside there? I'm sure.
So we deal more with the New York office, which is very different culture. The LA office definitely has that vibe. I definitely like big black Cadillacs in front of the office, you know, like a lot of that. But I mean, you know, it's their business. Like, it's like when you represent stars, like the biggest stars in the world, it's just kind of par for the course to be getting that image. But I mean, they're really nice. They're really helpful. That's all I'm asking for, you know?
Yeah, no, good. Great. Okay, cool. Let's and so that was a lot of that Series A was built on your deal with Fox, which is pretty cool. And then you fairly recently raised a Series B. Maybe talk about that. And what I like that you've done today is sort of say at each round what the core thing was that you were kind of pitching or that got the deal done. So Series B, what was kind of the thing there?
It was another major delivery milestone that was bigger than Fox, but that I can't talk about.
Okay.
Okay. So I wish I could really help you. Just, I guess, you know, keep an eye out for us because you'll hear about it soon enough. And it's just, you know, we're just breaking more and more barriers, and just, we managed to raise on that. And, I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah, that's fine. That's fine. we'll look for that. Maybe we'll do a follow on, you know, addendum after that deal's announced. We could have a little.
I'm down.
No, that's exciting. But I noticed, like Bertelsmann is in this deal, and that's another strategic, right? So did you kind of stick with the strategic mindset in raising this? Mm-hmm.
So again, like it's Bertelsmann is. So when we talk about strategic versus non-strategic, strategic typically, like for us, Disney would have been more of a strategic than Bertelsmann because Disney owns directly ESPN. And if we went to, we actually did try to get funding from Disney, by the way. And if we had, it would have been like a really easy door to a giant deal that would have been with ESPN. So that would have been a true strategic. When we have Bertelsmann, it's one of those things where it's what I call semi-strategic because they're in our industry. They completely understand. They even have stakes in companies that tangentially are related to us, or they can help open doors and et cetera. But they don't directly, even as investors to us, they don't go directly and go like, I want you to do a deal with this part of my branch or anything like that. So we've been super lucky to have this good balance between like a not fully strategic that has incentive to push you in a direction.
Yeah.
It's just like these major industry door openers. And that's true of Bertelsmann, and the type of doors they open are actually a little bit different than CAA as well. And they've also been very helpful, but it's that was more recent because it was like Series B related. So
yeah, good. If you're willing to share, why did Disney pass? Did they fund another startup, or are they
honestly? Do you ever really know why people pass? I honestly don't remember why they passed. I remember being in offices in LA and talking about it, and I remember getting a denial. I remember only rarely why people tell me they passed, because I often think it's bullshit. You know, at the end of the day, I've seen a lot of deals happen or not happen because their buddy, whoever's investor's buddy, are like, holy shit, you have to do this, I'm doing it. That will drive a deal more often than your numbers and your KPIs or the deals that you're making. So when somebody tells you like, I'm passing on this because your revenue numbers aren't high enough, sometimes it's just like, no, they have a bad feeling about it and they decided to follow their gut. And they pick the revenue as kind of an excuse. And at this point, you know, they don't really have incentive to really give a shit about you that much.
Yeah.
Sorry, I don't know if I need to censor myself or not.
Yeah.
So I don't remember Disney particularly.
No, that's fine. Yeah, I think you're right, though. I mean, what you're touching on there, it's like VCs often have, you know, the standard 6 or 7 default answers that they can just, and because they don't want to get in an argument of telling you really why they pass, right? Then it opens the door to like your counter argument, and they just don't want to do that. So, that makes sense. Was it hard? I don't know what the market is for VR. I mean, it seems like a few years ago I went to like TechCrunch Disrupt or Jason Calacanis' launch, and there were VR startups everywhere. And then, it seemed like there was just this proliferation of VR startups. Was it hard to raise money for a VR startup? Are people still kind of figuring out this space? Is it?
I mean, that question has changed a lot through the history of this startup and VR in general. I can tell you that, you know, when we hired our prototype back when, it would blow people's minds like crazy. It'd be like, oh my God, these tiny group of people made this thing that's like way different than what everybody does out there. And it really, like, even people that had seen a lot of VR said that this little thing is a significant difference. People still love what we do. We still impress people. They still totally do it, but a lot more people are very jaded on VR. There's been a lot of poor execution by other people and the expectations are low. There's also a lot of hype bubble bursts. So VR headsets like were promised that by 2018, they'd be 100 million of them in every home and everything like that. And that really is sort of like deflated everything. But I actually talked to a lot of VR CEOs. We're actually a pretty close-knit group, perhaps compared to most industries. And it's kind of like you think about Gartner's hype chart cycle. There's the big rise, then there's bubble bursting, and then there's like a slow rise. We're like steadily in the slow rise, like as much as the sort of like heat and sort of like foaming at the mouth has abated and slowed down. The general feeling is that, look, at the end of the day, no matter how good or how bad the VR headsets are, if I tell you that you got to forget what you know about VR today, but I tell you there's a magic box that you strap to your face and you feel like you're in a different universe where you can be wherever you want, you can do whatever you want, that concept is invincible to whatever market trend. It'll come back, whatever happens, because it's too powerful a concept. It's too real when you wear a VR headset. When you do one even pretty good experience, your brain will have trouble processing that it's not the real world. And that feeling is too powerful. So right now I don't want to say we're at the bottom of the barrel, because I think the bottom of the barrel was sometime in 2017, but it's come back up. And regardless of the hype or non-hype, we've managed to progress dramatically. So I actually forgot to mention something at the beginning, is that we actually are also available on iOS, Android without a headset. So when I say that we evolved out of VR, we actually, whenever we roll out Gear VR or mobile VR headsets, we also have a version where you can be on your tablet or on your phone, regardless of what phone you have, And you can kind of do like a 360 video where you can swipe around or turn your phone around the room, and you can use essentially the same application. And if somebody's in social and our social module on a phone, he or she can interact to somebody that's in Gear VR and vice versa. You can see each other, you can talk to each other, and the platform is not a limitation. It's less immersive, but it still fulfills our ultimate goal, that is sort of like make sports interactive and bring the entire sports experience into a digital experience, not just a video.
Cool, that's neat. All right, I know you have a hard stop because you got to take your team to the movie.
Yeah.
Ready Player One. But one last question. What advice would you give your younger self about fundraising if you were going to start this all over again? Or what general advice would you give maybe other VR entrepreneurs thinking about fundraising?
Well, the number one thing is don't lose hope, like grit. I once read that grit is the main definition, is the main thing that guarantees success. Like, even statistically speaking, it was like, if you took all the people that like have high net worth, etc., the most common denominator between them is actually very much grit. It's like not giving up. If you don't give up, you will fail sometimes. Like, you will get slapped in the face and your startup will fail and you run out of money and everything will suck. And things have sucked a lot at different times. And you, it's okay that you accept that you failed. That's totally normal. But then not trying again is the only wrong thing you can do. And literally, just if you fail three times in a row, don't start thinking something's wrong with me, I suck. You got to try again. Because a lot of these things, a lot of successes that we have, I don't take it for granted. I'm like, I'm lucky that CAA found us and that opened the door like dramatically. I'm lucky that David Stern had randomly this underdog loving personality that totally made the game, changed the game for me. I'm lucky that I found my co-founders. I'm lucky that I found my job that led me to have some VR experience before other people that gave me some credibility. I got lucky in so many ways, and I could have not gotten lucky, and I could be significantly nowhere. So when you're going to get hit with your 120th no from an investor, you're going to hate yourself, and you just got to remember these words, hopefully, like they stuck with me when I read them somewhere, I don't remember where. Just don't give up. Just keep going. And it's going to suck. It's going to super suck, but you just got to keep going, even if you hate everything.
Yeah, awesome. Well, this is good. All right, don't give up. I like that. This is awesome. So any call to action you want to make? I guess if people want to check you out, they can find it in the App Store. Or just livelikevr.com or any other, anything you want to plug?
I mean, you can check out our website, livelikevr.com. It's just, it'll give you a better idea of what we do. Probably, we also have a couple of YouTube videos if you look us up with Fox Sports. If you're in the US, download Fox Sports VR. It's got live content in there. You can watch it anytime and invite your friends from Facebook to hang out in there. Other than that, keep an eye out for just big international sports tournaments. There's probably one or a couple that are coming to mind.
Yes.
Yeah. Look out for potentially BBC doing some stuff in the VR space. Look out for Fox Sports. Look out for France Television. Look out for a lot of national broadcasters to do more stuff in VR, because they're always trying to move the ball forward. And the only thing they need is your eyeballs. So that's it.
Cool. Well, this is exciting. You're at a really exciting point in VR history, I think. So, all right, Andre, I appreciate very much. Enjoy Ready Player One with your team. Give me a report afterwards, and I wish you continued success.
Thank you very much for having me, and hope yours does well as well.
All right. Thank you, sir. Bye.
Thank you.